everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books we write and the lives we lead and how these two are one and the same. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the Internet, featuring video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And Author Magazine is funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn more about the PNWA as well as their fabulous yearly conference at pnwa.org. Well, when I read The Luminist, which was our guest David Rockland's debut novel, published last September or October, I can't remember now, but last fall, it occurred to me in reading it that David had taken a very definite narrative approach to his book. He sort of pushed the prose up against the edge of poetry. And this is the sort of choice a writer makes, it seems to me, that will attract very strongly certain kinds of readers and probably keep other readers away just as strongly. But, you know, there's really nothing a writer can do but to tell the story the way they most want to tell it. What else are you going to do? And that's just what he did. He told it the way he wanted to tell it. I have a lot of admiration for the strong choice he made, and I am really glad to have him on the show today. David, welcome to Author.
Very nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, David, like I said, you published The Luminist. Was it in October or September?
October. October in the U.S., I think late September in Italy, and the Israeli publication is yet to come.
Ah, all right. So it came out here in the States in October 2011. And so you've been – and this was your first published novel. And I'm trying to remember now, you hadn't had you published short fiction prior to that?
Well, it's such a long time ago that I don't think it even counts. I think the statute of limitations has run.
Right. All right. So this was really – you've been writing all your life. I think we had a lot in common. You said you had – we had both read The Lottery when we were 13, isn't that right?
That's right. Great memory. That's exactly right.
And with that, and 13 was kind of the year we, you and I both realized we both, this is writing was the thing.
Mm-hmm.
But like a lot of people, you're not 21. You published your first novel finally, and now you're an author. You are officially an author. How has this ensuing sort of, what has it been now, maybe 9 or 10 months been for you since the novel came out?
It's been the most joyful, glorious kind of chaos that I think I can imagine. There was a book tour that essentially took me to, I think, I want to say 8 or 9 cities between the period September to the end of 2011, with a couple of stray dates in 2012. And it, I think that I'm not quite to the point yet where I can honestly believe that people would want to come out and hear me. It still shocks me when somebody reaches out to me either at a reading or via email or through Facebook to say that they read the novel, first of all, and that they want to correspond or communicate about what the novel meant to them. I think I'm probably never going to get used to that feeling. It's just been extraordinarily meaningful.
That's an interesting thing, David. I was thinking about that and you before this interview, and I was talking to Jenny Shortridge about this last week in last week's show, and Laura Munson, who's a memoirist, had written about this experience, and I think this is a very particular thing that catches almost every first-time novelist, that is to say, novelist who gets their first novel published, by surprise, which is the fact that people read it.
Mm-hmm.
I know
it
sounds strange, but that human beings, strangers that you have never met, go out, buy it, and want to talk to you about it.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the kind of thing that happens to other people. It doesn't happen to me. And so when somebody – I've actually even had the experience of being recognized once from a book deck. And it's very surreal. It feels very dislocating in that I feel as though I'm watching it from somewhere quite removed from myself. And I'm obviously thrilled and extremely moved when someone says that they read it, that it means something to them, that they're going to carry it with them, that perhaps – it's going to be a vessel in which whatever they were feeling in their life at the time they read it, they look back on that time some years from now, and they think about the book almost as a marker for that particular point in their life, the way that I might with a movie or a book or a song. It's stunning, and at the same time, it's been interestingly and very wonderfully challenging to me as the person that I am. I'm not a center stage, have the attention focused on me kind of a guy. I'm
right.
usually much more of a do my thing, put it out there, let it speak for itself, and let other people have the spotlight kind of a person. So this has been, it's been a wonderful challenge, but it has definitely challenged a little bit my perception of myself.
Yeah, you know, it was Yann Martell who wrote The Life of Pi, which mm-hmm. went, as he, when I interviewed him, he described it as going global. So he was, you know, a guy who had written a novel or maybe a collection of short stories that hadn't really done much of anything, and, you know, and then he releases The Life of Pi, and it's, you know, goes crazy. And he was all over the world talking to people. And so when I talked to him about that experience of really being almost as famous as a novelist can be in that kind of framework, he won the Man Booker Prize and, you know, was number one in the New York Times and all this sort of thing. And he said, yeah, he said it was great. He said, but the thing is, the book was famous. I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Nope, I, he said, really still was nothing in compared to the book. It's not like a singer. It's not like an actor. You know,
right?
You yourself. It's really the book that everybody's interested. There, you are sort of seen through it, aren't you?
I hope so, and that's what that would make me happy. It's funny. I once had a conversation with my wife about this, where I talked about the fact that my strong preference would be for the book to go out there, the book to make its way, the book to speak for itself, the book to reveal to people why it was written. And sort of leave me out of it. And, you know, she had a very funny take on that. How do you separate those two things? And isn't that, in a way, your way of maybe downplaying the fact that you had achieved the completion of a novel? And that may be true, but I think it also is just reflective of how I look at this. I love the idea that the book goes to speak for itself and the writer is almost an afterthought in people's minds. I would much rather they hang on to the book than hang on to any aspect of me.
I think that's the best point of view, because I think it's the truest, because the fact is that your readers, all your various readers' experience of the book is really independent of you. Their book is not the book you wrote, per se.
Mm-hmm.
It's the book they read, which I've said this a few times, but every book is projected into the movie screen of the reader's imagination, and as they bring it to life, they use your writing, your words, as a beginning. But their imagination is the end. And so in that way, you were just, your book was just a catalyst. So it really isn't you. And I got to say, as a reader, I would much rather be aware of the characters and the story and maybe the language, although not overly so, but certainly, you know, enjoying it, than the writer. You know, I don't, as a reader, want to step back and say, wow, they really did it there. You know, I don't want to be too conscious of them because...
Mm-hmm.
You know, I may never meet them, or so on. So I think it's the most accurate position to take.
It's certainly the truest to just my own approach to writing. I'm vigilant, maybe to the point of being a little hyper vigilant about getting in the reader's way and inserting myself into the story unnecessarily where I really don't belong. If the writing feels too writerly, if the writing feels as though it's a phrase that I personally am attached to, but it doesn't necessarily belong to the story, I cut it, no matter how much I might like it, because I just
right.
I don't want to be in there. I have no business being in there. It's not a memoir. It's not about me. I'm not putting myself into the characters consciously, and I just don't want to be a presence in it. I want the reader to find their own world, create that world for themselves, infuse it with their own feelings and their own experiences, and really come to have a personal connection to it. And if I can do just that much, I'm going to die happy.
And you know what's interesting, David, is I just finished a memoir, and my agent, I guess, is going out with it this week. And
oh, fantastic.
And so,
congratulations.
Well, thank you. But what's interesting about the memoir, and I write this daily column for Author where I first started testing out sort of my memoir legs, because I would tell little stories about my own life. And what I discovered in those little stories, first in the magazine and then, of course, in writing this longer piece about a period of my life, what I learned was, in order for the memoir to be effective in my mind, as an artistic experience and also as of use to the audience, is even though, of course, I am the protagonist of the story, technically, it's not really about me. If I can use me as just a portal for understanding, then
mm-hmm.
the story works. But when it starts becoming about my victories and my little grievances it loses all its power. And it, the great thing about it is when you write about yourself in that way, you see your life differently. You see yourself, you don't see yourself, at least I didn't, as a victim anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because you were someone who made choices, and this was the result. But you weren't a victim of that person or that person's choices. This was just your my interpretation of those choices. For me, it was a great gift to me just writing the thing, and I hope that when people read it, it'll be useful to them too. But even then, I had to get myself, my idea, my identity out of it and use me, so to speak, use my
right.
life as an artistic experience.
Right, and that's to me, that's the most fun about reading nonfiction or reading memoir is that connective tissue. You know, it's not, and then I stood in the room and I did this, and this is how this is what I meant to people, and this is how important I was,
yeah.
or this is how this or that I was. It's really about that connective tissue between the person who was there and the person who is now interpreting, understanding, finding the various thematic strings that have run through their life, tying them together to that moment, learning from that moment, interpreting that moment in present time for us right now, for him or herself right now. That's the thrill, I think,
yeah.
of reading that, is to follow that connective tissue. And frankly, isn't it that connective tissue in memoir writing, at least, that usually starts the debate as to whether or not memoirs are overly fictional? Because you memoirs are memory, and memory is interpretation, and
oh, it's all,
we don't
you know,
have...
It's so close to fiction, David. It is
mm-hmm.
so oddly close to, having done all fiction my life and now found that memoir is perhaps where I'm happiest, it is so close, because it is memory and it's imagination, in that you must remember it. You aren't there.
Right.
You have to use your imagination to take yourself back to
mm-hmm.
that moment. And even then, you're still just remember. And you know what's funny? You know what you actually remember? Do you know what you actually remember is never what happened, although you have some idea of that. What you really remember is what you felt.
Yeah.
That's what you really remember, and that's what you're really writing, not what
Absolutely.
Happened.
And that's what we were talking about before, the vessel, you know, that
yeah.
when you're trying to reconjure those feelings, rekindle the memory, and capture not only what the moment was, but also how the moment resonated even then and forward through time to where you find yourself now when you're putting finger to keyboard.
Yeah.
It may be a song that you heard at the time or a movie that you saw or a book that you read, and they've contained the experience in a way that maybe we don't even realize.
Yeah.
But I always got a little bit annoyed with some of the debates over memoir and fiction and the crossroad and Is it right? Is it wrong? To me, those connective elements that do contain a little bit of speculation or
right.
recreation are always the most beautiful parts of memoir.
Yes, and in fact, I think I won't quote it again, but last week I was mentioning A Movable Feast, which is one of my favorite
mm-hmm.
pieces of...
Mm-hmm.
Not, but he says at the beginning, if you want, you can treat this as fiction.
Right, right.
Because, you know, and the fact is, like, I have scenes, like, in my memoir where I have dialogue because I just have to. Well, I cannot remember what I said precisely. I remember how it went. I remember certain things I remember very clearly. But the rest I have to kind of recreate. But I don't care because I want to create the truth of what I learned,
mm-hmm.
and I want to do it as honestly as I can. But it's not – this is not nonfiction like what Eric Larson, who wrote – he wrote, you know, Devil in the White City, which was
right.
a big one and some other stuff.
Right.
He really writes – he won't speculate on anything. Everything he puts down, he got from a letter or a journal or, you know, or facts, you know, in newspapers
mm-hmm.
and so on. But he doesn't try to speculate. He creates a story from what the facts he can gain are. You know, he can
right.
harvest
right.
are. The memoir
Although
is a work of art.
Absolutely. Although even in Devil in the White City, I seem to recall there were certain portions that I put my head up out of the book and thought, I'm betting he's speculating on that. And it might have
well,
been a route that the killer took or motivation
yeah.
for why somebody did something. And to me, that's fair and it's wonderful and it's interpretive and it's expansive on the subject matter material. And God, celebrate it. I mean, that's where the writer gets to apply what they do.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and so The Luminist obviously is not a memoir. It's a work of fiction, and not just a work of fiction, but a work of fiction set, was it 100 years ago?
In the
how, when was
approximately
it
the mid-19th century in Ceylon, India.
Right,
yeah.
So a long time ago. But
mm-hmm.
it doesn't, and so I've said this again and again, but it really doesn't matter when you put it. David Rocklin is in that book somewhere. Somewhere you're in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somehow or another, you exist within that. You have to draw on yourself, your own feeling, your own knowledge of what love is and what loss is and what fear is in order to recreate this place that you never lived in.
I think so, and I think, I mean, for me, particularly when I went back and read it the, you know, approximately 800 times that I did
during
the revision process, that's really when I first started noticing myself in there. And I was not aware of it at the time it was being written. It was just purely unconscious that elements of me snuck in. But I think where I saw myself perhaps most clearly would be in the character's reaction to wonder. In that moment, because there's love, there's loss, there's life and death and birth and recreation and, you know, all the things that hopefully make the story churn along at the appropriate pace. But where I really, in the last reading of it, where I really noticed my own sensibility most strongly was probably in the sense of wonder, that moment when suddenly the impossible is possible. That moment before it existed in the world and then the moment after it exists in the world, and how the person who witnesses the transformation from one moment to that ultimate moment is changed by having seen it. That's kind of where I found myself most prominently in terms of just what I know my sensibility is. And the rest of it, I think, would just be sort of the covert groundwater effect of having something that you might think or something you might believe or feel sneak into a character's particular point of view, but hopefully in an organic enough way that it's not just jarring myself or the reader out of the book and into, God, that feels contemporary. That really feels out of place. I wonder if that's the writer talking. Hopefully none of that happened.
I did not sense any of that when I read it. I felt it had that nice verisimilitude to it.
Thank you.
You know, you brought up an interesting point, and I think that as a writer, this is where, for me, the rubber hits the road, which is those moments in the thing you're writing where understanding occurs or a change happens, where a realization happens. And, of course, life itself doesn't change. All that changes is the character, it might be me in my own memoir or a character, sees life differently. So in the case of wonder, something opens up for him or her at that moment. And this is one of those things where those moments as a writer where I think you're tested in a way because you have to suggest it. I mean, the old show don't tell, but you have to suggest it and demonstrate it and still have it be felt and still have the full breadth of that understanding felt. I mean, when you go from seeing someone as an enemy to a friend, for instance, or not, or someone as simply as a comrade because of your perception shifting, it's a dramatic event, but as a writer, you can't hit them over the head with it. You have to allow them to see it, but you have to allow them to see the full breadth of it. And I think that's some of the most challenging and some of the most interesting moments as a writer to try and capture, that change that happens inside the character, but is all what life is about.
Right, absolutely. And to make that choice between depicting the emotional as well as the outward consequential aspect of whatever moment you're depicting in real time, versus in sort of the heightened sensibility time that happens in fiction that then hopefully the character looks back on, reflects, and helps us all grab the lesson or grab the impact or helps us all calculate just how far the ripples from that event go out. And, you know, that's one of the trickier choices is how long and how deeply into a moment do you go? Because obviously, I think in any good work of fiction, you can't spend your entire time tracing each and every moment and living within the moment, because then the story is not going to move, and then you're kind of fulfilling that stereotype of literary fiction, which is beautiful writing that doesn't move anywhere, versus genre fiction stereotype, which is pedestrian writing, but boy, it moves fast.
Right.
It really does that. Is that necessary to respect those demarcations? I don't think so. I think that some of the better literary writing I've ever read moves fast and is also beautifully spare or beautifully lush or just really well rendered in some fashion. And I think that pacing as well as the content of what's happening really depends upon the writer's instinct for allowing us all to live in that moment versus let's move us along. And those choices really define, frankly, a book that works and a book that probably doesn't.
Yeah, and I don't think there's a writer who takes their writing really seriously. Every writer who really cares about their story deeply would have to say they would hope that every sentence was necessary.
Yes.
That if it was, if it didn't move the story or the understanding within the story along, why is it there? Why would it be there? You know, and so ideally, whether you're writing a book that takes place, that say, one day in Dublin in 1910, over 600 pages, or, you know, 24 hours, Jeffrey Deaver style, you still want it to move. It must move because life moves, and you should be moving along with it, whether you take a long look at a single moment, because sometimes that can be delicious. It can be delicious when a writer really takes you into the profundity of one small moment, but done necessarily. Necessarily, not to indulge the writer's ability to say, look, I can do this.
Right.
Watch me take you in. Wasn't that amazing?
Stunt
that
writing,
happened.
Not a lot
it
of fun.
Happened.
Fun to do, not a lot of fun to read.
No, I don't think so. So I mentioned in my little introduction the approach, the sort of linguistic approach to The Luminous, which I really did feel took prose up to the edge of poetry, and not in every single sentence, but in a lot of them, I felt. And was that a choice you made for this story, or is it just how you tell stories, or how you felt you wanted to tell this one?
I would have to say, honestly, it's probably a semi-conscious, semi-unconscious combination of all of the above. I think a lot of it had to do with the point of view that I chose, and there's sort of a dual point of view happening in that novel between the character of Catherine and the character of Eligius. And both of them have certain perspectives that may heighten in terms of the sensibility depending upon how close they are coming to the impossible becoming possible. And with that moment, I think, comes a little bit of some of the more heightened prose that you're very graciously, very kindly describing. But part of it, I think, is also just I may have a particular sensibility that may in part be why my attempts at maybe writing in a contemporary way probably ought not be seen by the public. It just may not work that well. And the one I'm working on now, the new one I'm working on now, is also set in a period type of setting. And I don't think that the prose is quite as lush, but then again, I have a feeling it may become that as I get further into some of the aspects of the story, where once again, I think some of the point of view characters are going to approach moments that they had no idea would happen in their lives. And so I do think that part of it is a choice made depending on the characters, but I also think part of it may just be what I bring to the party.
Yeah. And so, you mentioned this is your second book now you're working on. I assume you have a contract. Are you going to use the same publisher?
You know what? The book, that the Luminist, was a single sale only.
Okay.
They have the publisher has the right of first refusal, but we'll see what happens when the manuscript is ready to go around. I had an amazing experience with my publisher. They are among the most phenomenal people in the world to work with, and I'd be honored to work with them again. But at the same time, you know, per the agent's sage advice, the market will certainly be tested.
All right, so I'm sure it will land somewhere. But here you are, writing along on your second book, and now you've had the experience of strangers reading it, buying it, spending actual cash money to buy it, and then wanting to talk to you about it. How has that experience, if at all, influenced the writing of this? What do you do psychically with that information as you write your next story? Because the first one, you wrote that without any knowledge of this.
That's true. That's true. And really, truly, no expectation. You know, as I was writing and I was watching sort of out of the corner of an eye what was happening in the publishing marketplace and realizing, this manuscript is not really developing around the idea of a sparkly vampire. And I don't think this is going to make its way from 19th century India to a dystopian near future where teenagers kill each other. So our chances here may not be awesome. So it was with incredible joy and great disbelief that I got that wonderful call that I really do hope every single writer in the world gets one day, when their agent says, hey, sit down, your book is going to be published, a publisher just acquired you. It's just an amazing moment. I hope everyone gets to have it. It's really remarkable. But it's interesting. Maybe I'm just really good at compartmentalizing, but I have not consciously been affected at all, for better or for worse, in terms of the hope for a second sale or the sophomore jinx or
what
might happen. It just really isn't entering my thinking at all. I think the only thing that's really seeping into my thinking is just maybe some of the lessons I learned through the editorial process with the publisher and trying to bring some of that to bear on how I write and, you know, where I know the last time people honed in on a couple of things, and I thought that's really excellent feedback. I'm going to keep an eye on that sort of thing too. But it's also still fairly early in the drafting process, so I give myself a lot of forgiveness in the early goings to be a little flowery, to be a little lush, to be a little emotional about the writing and let the writing reflect that, because as you probably know, if you have anything like a life around your writing, you don't get to write 24 hours each day. So there are things that happen in between. There's kids to deal with and just, you know, work and life. So you write, you stop, and then you get back to it as soon as you can. And there's this tendency, at least on my part, to just sort of artificially boost myself back into the moment. And that usually results in the first draft or two in kind of heightened prose. And so in my revision process, in addition to looking at things like pace and story and characterization, I'm also keeping an eye out for sentences where I can almost pinpoint them and say, oh, you know what, I bet that was the first sentence I wrote on the very next day that I could start writing again.
Right.
You can just kind of tell.
Right. You know, it's so important, as I listen to you talk about this, that a writer understand his or her process. So I would, if I were you describing how you write your first draft, I wouldn't show that to anybody, not out of embarrassment, but out of an understanding that this is not for anyone. I know what's right and wrong with it, and I know it. I wouldn't bother showing that. And I think it's really important. Some writers, Wally Lamb, for instance, who's had obviously a great career, he is in all kinds of writers' groups, constantly sharing his work. And then most of the writers I know aren't in writers' group and don't like to share it so much. And some, you know, there's all everywhere in between. But you've got to know, and there's no right answer with this, and you've got to know how you work. I don't like to show. I used to show stuff to people. I don't do it now until I'm really done all I can possibly do with it. And then I maybe show it. Maybe, but my memoir, my wife still hasn't read it. She's in the damn thing, and she hasn't read it yet. So,
you may want
to
buy her, just to be sure.
Yeah, well, eventually I probably will. Oh, we have a guest. Maybe they have a question for us. I have just a minute or two, so I'm going to see if I can have this guest give us one quick question. You ready, David?
I'm ready.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Bill. It's Jeff, R. Jeffries.
Hi, Jeffrey. How are you doing?
David, wonderful, wonderful interview.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Very, very insightful. Yeah, quick question is, developing characters, we draw from all different sources. Do you find yourself gravitating to specific sources or experiences which really help you to see your characters very much clearer? What's the process? Because I know we're very short on time. And Bill, thank you for taking the call.
Oh, no problem. I'm going to put you on hold while we answer that, Jeffrey.
Well, thank you, David.
No, thank you very much for calling in and for the question. I would say that my process with regard to characterization really moves inward and then outward. I usually don't start with the characters. I start with the circumstance because I think a lot of what defines characters really depends upon what is happening outside of them and how they react to it. There's this old writing trope that I heard once about your character is approaching an intersection and the light goes from green to yellow. What do they do?
Right,
and how you answer that question really is somewhat reflective of who they might be, and then the web of that moves outward as you begin to play games with what else might the character do in different situations. If you can bring that into your book and into the central conflict and the central backstory of your book, and you ask yourself, what would my character do with this? Are they pleased with this? Are they rebelling against it? Do they fit? Do they not fit? Are they aware of how they fit? Start playing those question games with yourself, and pretty soon you have a pretty well-fleshed-out character.
Excellent answer. On that note, David, I'm going to have to say goodbye. Thank you so much for being on Author to Author.
My pleasure. I had a great time.
All right. It's The Luminist. It's still out there in stores. You can find it anywhere, of course, on Amazon. And thank you all for listening. This has been Bill Knauer. Next week I'll be talking to Erica Bauermeister. Remember, do what you love, write what you love, and you can't go wrong. Hi, everybody.